Thanks, Chad, for those songs, and for Dennis for the comments that he had for us this morning to get our minds on eternal things. The passage before us, no temptation is overtaking you, but such is common to man. And God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able, but with the temptation will provide the way of escape, so that you may be able to endure it. Maybe with the exception of the very small children here, I don't think there's anyone here this morning that says in their head, temptation, what's that? Mark, I don't understand what you're talking about. This is just one of those passages in Scripture that you can pick it up for the first time and you know what it's talking about. Whether you're a believer or an unbeliever, whether you believe in God or don't believe in God, everyone knows what temptation is. We all know what it feels like. We know what it feels like for the adrenaline to hit us, and when our heart starts beating a little faster when we're tempted to do something that we know that's not right. We all know that feeling. We all know the feeling afterwards, that if we give into it, we know how that feels. That we don't feel good about ourselves. And it's a very hopeful passage because it says we all have this in common. Everybody else can identify with being tempted. We're all there. We're on the same boat together. And it's not like the temptation that really appeals to me is unique to me. And it's not like that no one understands that. There's a lot of other people that are tempted by the same sort of things that tempt me and tempt you. There's hope here that you don't have to live a life of continuing to fail and fail. And fail, beat me this time, and beat me this time, and beat me this time. There is a way out. There is a way out if we want that way. There is a way of escape. It also tells us that since it's common to man, that there's going to be a lot of other people that are going to say, oh yeah, know exactly what that's like. But here's how I, with God's help, here's how I got the upper hand on that. If you read much about famous people, if you read many autobiographies, that verse is true. Famous people are tempted as well. I started a book on Eric Clapton, not sure if I'm going to finish it just because, you know, it's the rock and roll lifestyle, but early on, yeah, he couldn't handle alcohol either. He's tempted by the same stuff we're all tempted by. And so I wanted to do kind of a lesson on, like, well, what do you do? What do you do when you're being tempted? And so I wanted to take a few things on that. The first thing I think that I would want us to know biblically is that don't sell everything you have for the one thing you don't have. That's what Adam and Eve did in the garden in Genesis chapter 3. Don't get focused on the one thing that you don't have. In Genesis 3:6, when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was a delight to the eyes, that the tree was desirable to make one wise. And yet she forgot about at that moment that they could eat as much as they wanted from every other tree of the garden. At that moment she forgot, but we have God. We have this relationship with God. We are in paradise. We are in a garden. There is no sin right now. She got focused on the one thing that was off limits. And that happens in a lot of temptations. When you're tempted to do something, the devil wants you to make a swap. I want you to trade a lot of the neat things you have now for this one temporary pleasure. And to remember that whatever the devil is offering you is not going to last. It doesn't last very long. It's like fruit stripe gum. It's amazing in the verse. It's the first 5 seconds is amazing. After that, you're just chewing on a piece of rubber. After that. It's like that. Yielding to this temptation will not offer me any personal improvement. I'm not going to get any better here. If I feel bad now, and you always feel a little bit bad before you yield, because sometimes you resent God. You resent that God says, I can't do this. So you feel a little bit bad, but you're going to feel a whole lot worse later. And it's always that way. When it comes to temptation, be honest, this particular temptation has never worked for you, and it's never worked for anyone else. By worked, I mean it's never made anyone fulfilled or happy. It's never delivered what it's promised. It's never worked for anybody else. Have long-range thinking. What will my life be like 5 years from now if I do this? What will I wish 5 years from now I had done? What will I wish 10 years from now that I had done? Your life is precious. Your energy is precious. Your time is precious. Do I really want to spend my valuable time, energy, and life doing this? That's tempting me. Is that what I was created to do? That? Is that what life is all about? Is it there's something bigger than that? I think I'm more valuable than that. I think my life is more important than spending it doing that. God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son that whoever believes in Him should not perish. That means I do have value. Sin can do things to your body. And I think we know of that. I mean, you become an alcoholic and sin is going to do stuff to your body. But I think what we forget about is what sin can do to your brain. What sin can do to your mind. There's a passage back in Isaiah chapter 59 that I was thinking of along this lines. Isaiah chapter 59, verse 9. Therefore, justice is far from us, and righteousness does not overtake us. We hope for light, but behold darkness, for brightness, but we walk in gloom. We grope along the wall like blind men. We grope like those who have no eyes. We stumble at midday as in the twilight. Among those who are vigorous, we are like dead men. All of us growl like bears and moan sadly like doves. 12, for our transgressions are multiplied before you, and our sins testify against us. And I think he's talking about something that's, it can be physical, but it's really mental there too. I can be surrounded by people with energy, and I don't have any energy. I'm just like in this dark place. And I think of what the Ephesian writer said, Paul. He talks about don't walk any longer as the Gentiles walk. And then he says, in the futility of their mind. Sin does stuff to your head. It does stuff to your perspective. It does stuff to your thinking. Remember how ridiculous Pharaoh became. I mean, one plague after another. The Nile is blood. I think you should let them go. There are frogs all over the place. I think you better let them go. All the crops are destroyed because of hail and things like that. I think you should let them go. Every firstborn in Egypt just died except among the Israelites. I think you should let them go. Oh, there's this cloud protecting them. We can't get to them. I think you should let them go. Oh, the Red Sea parted. And dry land is there, and they've gone through. I think you should let them go. And the Egyptian rushing after them with thoughts of vengeance. And you're going like, that's crazy. Yeah. Sin makes you crazy in that sense. Now, you might not be living on the street type of crazy, okay? You might not be somewhere where you're hospitalized crazy. There's a lot of people that hold jobs, etc., but they're crazy. They're not thinking straight. And sin has the power. Sin has the power to do that to an individual. There's a passage in Jeremiah 42. Jeremiah 42, where the people come up to Jeremiah and say, just tell us God's word and we're going to do it. Verse 5. Verse 5 says, then they said to Jeremiah, chapter 42, may the Lord be a true and faithful witness against us if we do not act in accordance with the whole message which the Lord your God will send you to us. Whether it is pleasant or unpleasant, we will listen to the voice of the Lord our God. And guess what? A message comes from Jeremiah. And at the end of Jeremiah's preaching, verse 2, all the arrogant men said to Jeremiah, you are telling a lie. The Lord our God has not sent you to say, you are not to enter Egypt, to reside there. See, they wanted to go to Egypt after Jerusalem had fell. And they come to Jeremiah and said, we'll do anything God says. And God says, stay here, don't go to Egypt. The problem is, that's not what they wanted to do. And when that message comes out, they say, you're lying. That's crazy. To go up to a guy and says, hey, just whatever. And they already said, whether it's pleasant or not, we'll do it. I don't know. When I look at that, I'm going like, is that me? Because I think there are times in our lives that we go, hey, whatever the Bible says, I'll do. Someone shows us what the Bible says on a particular point. Well, and then we change our mind. Sin can make you think like that you're a believer, that you're really spiritual and things like that. Oh, I'll do whatever God says. And then here's a passage that says, do this. The real test is, will you obey God when God goes against your preconceived ideas for how to do something? Will you obey God when you follow God's plan for what the church should be, not your vision for what the church should be? Will you follow God when God lays out His plan of salvation, not what you want the plan of salvation to be? Will you follow God when God says, here's the way to worship versus here's the way I want to express my worship? That, I think that's the real test, because I think Jeremiah 43 verse 2 is not very unique. A lot of other people have done the exact same to God. We'll do whatever you say. And yet God lays down His will, and it's not their will. In Proverbs chapter 23 verse 29, as you grow up, learn. As you grow up, learn. As you grow up, observe people. Observe people older than you. Do you want to become like that person? Look at the road they're on. Look at the road they're on and see where that road heads up. Proverbs 23:29 says, who has woe, who has sorrow, who has contentions? And it's who has complaining, who has wounds without cause? And then it's that person that lingers long over wine and things like that. Take a look at people older than you, the choices they're making, and ask yourself, do you want to become like them? Because that's where that road leads. Proverbs 13:15, the way of the transgressor is hard. Sin messes up everything. It messes up everything. And I don't know if I can think of something that sin does not mess up. Because it messes up your thoughts, it messes up your perspective, it messes up your mood, it messes up your finances, it messes up your relationships. I really can't think of something that sin does not like mess up or gum up, where now it just doesn't work like it used to work. In Titus chapter 3 verse 5, for we once were foolish, ourselves disobedient, deceived, enslaved the various lusts and pleasures, spending our life in malice, envy, hateful, hating one another. To me, that's what I mean by it burns bridges. Is that you burn relationships. Sin will cause you to burn relationships. Someone is telling you what you need to do. Someone in you is trying to reach out and tell you what God says in His Word. And you go, I don't want to hear it. That's burning a bridge. You do something, you should say you're sorry, but you say like, I'm not going to say I'm sorry. You're burning a bridge. Someone asked you to do something out of your comfort zone. I'm not going to do that. And I think sin just causes us to burn bridges in our lives. And I think Romans chapter 1, 29 through 21, 31 is very similar, where you encounter phrases like disobedient to parents, unmerciful, unloving, strife, deceit, gossip. That's burning bridges. That's burning bridges with other people. Sin is also, I don't know, maybe you've had a love-hate relationship before with something. I love it, but I hate it type of thing. I think sin is the classic love-hate relationship. I think of what Paul said in Romans 7:16. If I do the very thing I do not want to do, you know, if I do the very thing I hate, part of you wants to do it, and yet you feel horrible when you do it. Isn't that true of just about any temptation? There's part of you that wants to do it. There's part of you that's attracted to it, but then part of you just like beats up on yourself after you do it. Well, there you go again, only thinking about you. You're pitiful. It's that love-hate relationship. John 8:34 is a passage you know very well. Everyone who commits sin is the slave of sin. But here's the trap that we all get caught up in. That only happens to weak people. Only people that are weak become the alcoholic. Only people that are weak become the drug addict. Only men that are weak end up in adultery. Wait a minute. I remember a David in the Old Testament who ended up in adultery, and he wasn't weak. He's not a weak man. I remember a Solomon who ends up building pagan altars for his wives, and you would not typify Solomon during a lot of his life as, well, he's a weak, spineless man. He's someone who doesn't know who he is. Those were not weak people. Don't buy the lie that certain things all... The only reason that person ended up there is because they didn't know who they were and they were weak. No. There's a lot of people that are incredibly strong, but they start dabbling with sin. And I don't care how strong you are, you start dabbling with sin and you're not going to be able to handle it no longer how strong you are. And so that passage in John 8:34 helps me. Jesus says, everyone, the strongest person, if David starts practicing sin, he's a slave. If Solomon starts practicing sin, he's a slave. I don't care who you are. If Peter the Apostle starts practicing sin, he becomes a slave too. Don't believe that only happens to weak people. It can happen to anybody who follows that path. When Abraham yielded to fear, he started lying too. And Abraham was not a weak person. But that just happens to anyone. I start going down the path of sin and I'll end up doing the same thing. When I yield to temptation, it creates a secret life I have. And you start thinking things like, if people really knew me, the real me, people really knew what I was doing, they would reject me and they wouldn't like me. I think the devil kind of plays games with us. The devil's like a really bad boyfriend who charms a woman and then tears her down at the same time. He sweet talks her and then he attacks her. So she's always like off balance. The devil's like that with us. He will say things like, "You are awesome. You are amazing," etc. Then he'll say, "You're pitiful. You are a loser. There's no hope for you." I think he plays both sides of that with us. And we start thinking things like that. We start becoming paranoid. We start withdrawing from when we get into sin. We start withdrawing into ourselves. Because we have this secret life. And this is something really caught me in a book. I quote from this book at least twice in a lesson. I'm not going to recommend it. I read it. It had some thoughts. I'm not going to recommend the book. I thought it was written by someone that he's a believer, but I would call him a rather worldly believer. And there are a couple points now and then, but he's someone who drinks. He's someone who smokes. Goes to a church where the preacher cusses and etc. And to me, I'm going like, I don't know what version of Christianity that is, but I don't think it's the one I can read about in the Bible. So I'm not going to recommend the book, but this is a quote that came from it. I know someone who has twice cheated on his wife. He said he would lie down next to his wife at night, feeling walls of concrete between their hearts. He had secrets. She tries to love him. He knows he doesn't deserve it. He cannot accept her affection because she is loving a man who doesn't exist. He plays a role. He's an actor in his own home. That's what sin does. I'm an actor in my own home. It's sometimes good to look at the company, look at the group of people that are involved in something. If someone is trying to lure me into, come on, come and join us, it's better here. Often sin will say, no one judges you here. Well, that's not really true. That's not really true. Even when you're in their presence, they might not. But I found that when I was in the world, that once you left, they started talking about you. Once you left your friends. When I was in the world, I found that when you're in the world, you tend to lie to one another. I know a lot of people that you're in the world and people steal, your roommates steal from you and stuff like that. You have your friends over and they're going through your medicine cabinet looking for your prescription drugs. When you get into that particular lifestyle, they hide money from one another, that sort of thing. And so just be honest about the world. The world out there. No, not everyone in the world is addicted. Not everyone in the world is. But I don't like when there's these wide sweeping generalizations when people are in the world and are going like, hey, we're loving and we're accepting. Well, wait a minute. That's not really the truth about the world either, because Titus says that we were enslaved. Titus says that we were hateful. And Titus says that we hated one another. One of the things when I think about David is that David gets involved with adultery with Bathsheba, and all of a sudden David can't control how the story plays out. She's pregnant now. David can't control the actions of Uriah, her husband. He brings Uriah back. He tries to say like, well, he's going to naturally go home and be with his wife. So he will think when the baby's born, the baby is his. He can't control Uriah. He finds out Uriah's this man of principle who says, hey, I'm not going to go home and be with my wife and etc. if all my comrades are out still fighting this battle. And David can't get Uriah to do that. He can't control the ramifications of his sin. And that's something I always want to remember, that once you yield to a temptation, you can't call the shots of, okay, this is how far that's going to go, or this is how much damage that is going to do. It's somewhat like the wildfire in the gorge. I guess some of our fires recently have kind of, I guess I had the wrong idea about firefighting. Wildfires. I actually thought that they put out the fires or whatever. But a lot of these, it looks like that they just are trying to somewhat keep it somewhat contained and let it naturally burn out. But sometimes that fire just goes like that fire is going to go where it wants to go, and all the men on the ground and Accenture is not going to stop it. All of a sudden, from 10 acres, you have 100,000 acres. I think sin's like that. Sin can go from 10 acres to 100,000 acres all of a sudden, and wow, now I got a big... And David's sin is like that. In 2 Samuel 12, verse 11, here's what God says. Behold, I will raise up evil against you from your own household, and I will even take your wives before your eyes and give them to your companion, and he will lie with your wives in broad daylight, speaking of what Absalom would do a few chapters later. Now, when God says that he's going to raise up evil in David's household, I do not think that God is saying, I'm going to cause Absalom to do this or force him to do this, because God doesn't do things like that. I think he's predicting what's going to happen. David, you don't realize, but the word of your adultery is out. In fact, in this chapter, verse 14, not only would other people in Israel find out about this illicit relationship, but however, because by this deed you have given occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme, David, not only is Israel, Jerusalem, going to know about this, but people in other nations are going to know about this. And you don't realize what you've just unleashed. And to me, it's interesting that, of course, the child would die. There's something else that he could not control. The child dies. But it's interesting that right after the consequences come down on David, in chapter 13, David has a son, Amnon, who is just infatuated by his stepsister and ends up raping her. And to me, I think the link's pretty strong, is that David's immorality starts setting this tone in his own family. Well, if dad can do that, then if dad can yield to that, if dad can do something that, then I've got this dark thing, then instead of saying that's not right to think that way, instead of controlling my thoughts, I don't do that. And then Absalom, and so out of this one sin, David is going to lose three children. The child dies, Amnon, because of his sin, Absalom murders him, and Absalom's then going to end up dying too, and so he's going to lose three children because of this. I don't think David ever thought that night when he saw Bathsheba bathing that, okay, so I'm going to go and be with her, and then I'm going to murder her husband, and then I'm going to lose three of my children. Yeah, that's worth it. I don't think David was thinking that. And I think that's the thing about sin, is that you really don't know where it's going to end up at. You really can't control it. It just seems to me that there's a number of people that were once faithful to God. It could be that there's been a number of people that their mom and dad brought them to the Lord's church, and they have fallen away. And here's the thing I think sometimes that happens. I think years later, you kind of go like, what happened? There is a movie in the scene, Sand Pebbles, with Steve McQueen, that he ends up on this boat in China during this, I think it's the Boxer Rebellion and stuff like that, and is going past to rescue some missionaries in this temple. He's got this Browning automatic rifle. He's in there. He's about ready to leave as he's covering everyone, and a bullet hits him in the chest and knocks him down, and he goes, what happened? And he dies. And I think the thought is like, wait a minute, how did I get to this point? How did my life end up here, and why is my life stopping here? What happened? I don't want to be someone that death takes me and the next moment I'm before God and I'm not right and I go like, what happened? What happened? Because I knew the truth. Either mom and dad taught me or I was converted or whatever. What happened? I actually did know the truth, and for a while I was walking the truth and living the truth. What happened? I think sin can easily do that to us. There has to be men who knew the truth. Unfortunately, men that leave their wives, and the wife leaves, and they're in the house or apartment by themselves, and the thought must strike them at that moment. What happened? How did I get here? How did I get here? And that's the thing. When you're in sin, sin does not want you to think about where you're going. It does not want you to think about the destination. It does not want you to examine your life right now and say, whoa, 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 where am I right now? And where do I want to be? As hard as it is, I don't know if anyone can even really live a secret life for long, because Numbers warns in Numbers chapter 32, verse 23, God told Israel, be sure your sin will find you out. It's going to catch up to you and it's going to overtake you. And there's a statement also in the book of 1 Timothy chapter 5 where Timothy says that is told, the sins of some men are quite evident, verse 24, going before them to judgment, like everyone can see it. For others, their sins follow after. If I'm not following God, I am going to cause someone to stumble. I'm going to lead someone astray. Years ago, when I first became a Christian, I know today's Sunday, but I forgot the date. 17th? Tomorrow, 38 years being a Christian. I was baptized 38 years ago tomorrow. September 18th, 1979. About a year or so after I'd become a Christian, there was a couple there at church. They had like five kids, young couple, five kids. I remember going there one night to like some sort of social event, you know, after services, after me and Cindy were newly married. Well, she leaves her husband. That's probably been 36 years ago now. Well, kind of the whole family falls apart. The dad stops going to services. You know, I never see any of the kids anymore. Book of Ecclesiastes says one sinner destroys much good. There may be 50 lost people today because of that one event. As far as I know, when she left, he did not stay with the faith. And as far as I know, none of the kids stayed with the faith. And I don't think they all never married anybody. So you got other spouses. There may be 50 people that are not right with God today because of one person's decision. And I guess that's just what it means, is I'm going to end up causing someone to stumble. I've seen that so many times. Someone leaves the faith in a congregation. Someone leaves the faith and someone else kind of goes with them. I don't want to do that. I think Jesus deserves better than that. It's interesting. I was reading a book and this guy was talking to this girl and they were talking about like racism and stuff like that. And he says, you know, that may be more of a minor issue. She goes, what do you mean by that? What do you mean that racism is a minor issue? Well, he said, but yeah, it's there and it's bad, but I think the bigger issue is just self-absorption. That we just think about ourselves. We're thinking about our needs. We don't think about anybody else. That's really what's behind racism, is selfishness, self-absorption. And she called it what's sin. That is the big thing out there. That is the big thing out there. How do you address addiction without addressing sin? Or maybe another way, how do you go about trying to help somebody have addiction without addressing sin? How do you help marriage problems without addressing sin? How do we address the national debt without addressing sin or selfishness? How do you address crime without addressing sin? I mean, isn't that you got this issue out here, but isn't the issue beneath it selfishness, self-absorption. That's really the issue that we're talking about. You know, I go out to people that are living on the streets, and I go out to people that are homeless, and my heart goes out to people like that. But even in that, at some point, we're going to have to talk about God, right? We're going to have to talk about God and a person's relationship with God, and we're going to have to talk about that as well. All of those issues come back to, I think, the answer to stuff is God. And my thought was just like, I think there's enough pain, estrangement, suffering in the world that I don't have to pile on with my stuff. I don't have to add any more misery to that. But when I'm sinning, I'm adding more. I'm piling on. There's not enough. I'm going to pile on. Here's my stuff to pile on top of it. To me, also, I think as you get older, it just kind of gets magnified. I mean, it's one thing for a young man to be involved with the wrong woman. That's bad enough. But when Solomon is involved with the wrong women, then it really looks bad. It's one thing when a young woman is being immodest. It's another thing when a woman who's 60 is being immodest. It's all wrong. But it's almost like the foolishness is magnified. It's one thing when an 18-year-old doesn't know how to handle money. It's another thing when someone 72 doesn't know how to handle money. Then it looks really foolish. Here's the thought. Whatever I don't address in my life is going to look really bad as I get older. Any sin that I don't address in my life is just going to look worse as time goes by. Sin also creates an appetite that you cannot satisfy. It's just like, now I need a little bit more to do the same thing. I think you see that in Romans 1. Here are people that abandon God and go to idols, but that doesn't satisfy them. So we go off into loose sexual living, but that doesn't satisfy them. So we go off and attach ourselves to people of the same gender sexually, but it's almost like that's not going to satisfy them. And you see that progression in Romans chapter 1. I guess right now, really care about what happens to you. Have a talk with your future self. Where do I want to be one day? Love yourself enough to save yourself. Love yourself enough to accept God's offer of salvation. Because God said, I have no pleasure in the death of anyone who dies, declares the Lord. Therefore, repent and live. And dies there is in the sense of die spiritually. Every choice right now we're making is creating a future for us. Good choices are adding more opportunities in our future, and bad choices or non-choices that we should be making are limiting our opportunities, future blessings, future happiness. Do not just have the attitude of, I'll just wait and see what happens. Don't believe the lie, it won't happen to me. And Satan's not tempting you because he likes you. And happiness is never found on the path of selfishness. I learned that when I read books too. When I read books about people's lives, I learned that, well, selfishness didn't work for them either in that part of their life. Well, Mark, it doesn't work for anyone. You cannot be a Christian. You can hold a job. You can have a nice house, and you can do a number of things like that. But I don't know. The older I get, I just don't think anyone does well without God. There's a certain part of your life that you're not doing well without Him. You may be surviving, existing, etc. But I know I don't do well without God, and I don't think I'm unique like that. I just don't think anyone really does well without God. So one writer said, true change, life-giving, God-honoring change has to start with the individual. If you really want to change the world, change you first. I know a lot of people talk about stuff, but change you first. I think of Acts chapter 17, verse 6. When they did not find them, they began dragging Jason and some brethren before the city's authorities, shouting, "These men who have upset the whole world have come here also." I want to be one of the men that upset the whole world. I think the world needs some upsetting. But I'm not going to be able to have any influence on the world unless I'm a changed man. Change yourself, and you'll change the world. "He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved." Let's be standing as we sing the invitation song.